Welcome to another episode of Before You Kill Yourself with your host, Leo Flowers. I am Leo Flowers. Today's guest is Darren Norden. I met him on a cruise ship that I was recently working on. I was sitting there. I think it was lunch or dinner. And he grabbed a seat next to me, table next to me. And we just started talking. And he shared with me that, one, he has a military background, and two, he has a son who was who started out as a woman but transitioned into a man and is now 18. And he was sharing with me his challenges, initial struggles with the transition and raising a son. And I thought that was fascinating because there for two reasons. One, there's so many people who want to transition and they're not sure what that looks like and the challenges with it. Two, I think that there are parents who have children who want to transition and they don't know how to handle it, how to cope with it, how to have the discussion, that there's a financial investment involved. And I think three, that there are children who want to transition and may not understand their parents' perspective. So to me, this is a great opportunity for parents to understand, for children to understand, and for us as a society to understand what's involved. And also to talk about Darren's military history and find out how he was able to make that transition from the military into a civilian life. So welcome to the podcast, Darren. I appreciate you being
here. Oh, great. It's great to be here, Leo. Thanks for having me.
So what branch of the military were you in?
Air Force. Yes.
How long did you serve?
Yes, indeed. Or not the chair force, but the Air Force.
you actually did some work. You were getting things done. You guys just weren't sitting around twiddling your thumbs.
Right. The only reason why I say that is just because when I deployed with the Army, I was an Air Force asset that was essentially put on loan and borrowed by the Army. So I kind of embedded with the 4th Infantry in the Army, and they treated me like one of their own. They kind of adopted me. But I just remember that they would tease me sometimes, even though I wore their uniform and did everything with them. They would tease me like, oh, do you want an air-conditioned office somewhere? Or they would say that I was part of the chair force, as they would say. So not the ribbing was kind of funny.
You know, when we hear about people in the military, it's often portrayed as either so glorious and you know, idolized, and you know, they can, you know, we look at these movies about the SEAL teams and you got Top Gun, it looks so cool and glossy, or it's like extremely like depressing and they're struggling with you know, injuries and PTSD. And for you, what did you find your experience was more aligned with?
Well, a little bit of both. Sometimes it was better than I thought it would be, and sometimes it was worse than I thought it would be. And some of the things that are most difficult with the modern warfare, particularly in urban areas, is the propensity for not only physical injuries and casualties and from bullets and so forth, but also the mental injuries that you can't see and that are still just as very real to the person, such as trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder is very prevalent, as well as head injuries, TBIs, which sometimes can happen, you know, even when you're at a safe distance from an explosion, just because of the air waves and the vibrations, and it can cause concussions as well, just from the reverberating air.
Can you say more about that? Because I know for myself that's a part of the injuries or the trauma that's not really talked about, is the the effects just from bombs going off. Maybe you physically look fine. You haven't lost an arm or leg. You're not even bleeding. But the impact of the explosive going off may have caused some type of internal damage that's not visible to the eye.
That's right. Yeah, because the bombs, the weapons are getting very sophisticated, and the kind of the new signature injuries that a lot of soldiers and airmen are experiencing are TBIs when they didn't have any broken skin or weren't directly involved, but just from being kind of flown across the room, and the concussion waves that travel from these more sophisticated types of IEDs are getting to the point where they can cause brain injuries, and there might not be a physical cause to it other than the wound of being too close to the concussion wave.
It brings to mind the idea of a candle, right? Most, like, when we think about harm done by fire, we think about being set on fire, but the heat from a flame can do just as much damage, right? And
exactly.
It's kind of like the you talked about the concussion waves. That's like the heat from the flame.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And so we're having a lot of casualties like this, Leo, and without losing an arm necessarily, or as many people physically dying, but the PTSD piece of it as well, the loss of control, being knocked out, being temporarily disabled, and feeling like you can't really contribute to the mission. All of these things can cause emotional harm to the soldier, airman, or Marine, or whoever, that is difficult to measure and difficult for insurance companies to allocate funds for in a tangible way. And a lot of times they feel a sense of shame because they don't have an injury that they can point to. They can't say, look, obviously I'm wounded. I'm missing an appendage. There's no prosthetic for a wounded soul. And so these are wounds that are very difficult to assess. They're very difficult to, because of the shame that provides a barrier to care for some of these people that desperately need the help and someone to talk to and support and coping mechanisms to deal with this phenomenon of the fight or flight process going on in their body that is now going awry and being triggered by all of these things in civilian life that even somehow unconsciously approximate the same set of stimuli that they encountered downrange. So it's very hard to treat. There's a lot of denial about it, a lot of shame about it. People come back, wounded warriors, and they believe erroneously that they need to be stoic and strong and not show weakness. Or a lot of them have even been taught to believe there really is no such thing as PTSD or emotional wounds from war, because they feel that somehow it's less real, it's less tangible, and they feel ashamed of it. They feel like this means they're weak, and that's a very tough pill to swallow emotionally. So that's why, in regards to your initial question, your introduction, when you were talking about the transition of soldiers, airmen, troops, Marines, seamen. So the transition of these folks when they get back from being downrange or in a deployed situation is often difficult because they all tend to be, they don't get out of this unscathed emotionally. And there is a transition. They go from a hyper-adrenalized situation downrange, and they get used to that feeling. They get addicted to it. The biochemical signature of these meds, I mean, of these neurotransmitters and the whole cascade, you know, in the constellation of PTSD, that whole cascade, it is easily triggered by things when they return home. And it creates, while they are away, deployed, it creates a scenario where they're waking up every day. And from the time that they wake up until the time they go to bed, if they are able to sleep at all, they're experiencing a chronic, constant adrenalized state that has them on edge. It's meant in the animal world to keep us alive. It shunts blood away from the internal organs and to the extremities so that we can fight. And it mobilizes our hormones and everything to make us in a suitable state to fight. And that's all well and good in the animal kingdom. But when you're in a war zone situation, it's easy for that system to just be running on high, and getting the corresponding cortisol hit is not very good for the brain function either, which might explain why a lot of these people experience a general malaise and a feeling that just feeling unwell and constantly stressed and tense, which can cause them back problems or exacerbate any existing back problems that they have. These things, and that's why it's so hard to measure the astronomical toll that PTSD and, you know, having some sort of stress disorder as a result of traumatic exposure, either downrange or wherever, it adds up, and we can't measure this stuff because it has a trickle-down effect. A stone in a pond, it ripples, and it affects every facet, every area of these people's lives.
How does the military prepare you, if at all, to cope with that? For someone who may have, experienced a concussive wave, and they are struggling with PTSD, you know, while you're in the military, is there a protocol for, hey, you had this type of exposure, we need you to go see these people and talk to these people?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's combat stress teams that are set up all over the deployed areas, but also, back home in garrison, they're there too. They call them, usually back when I was involved, it was called life skills, and it was ways that you could, you know, be identified and monitored for your symptoms to see if you could still function and be considered fit for duty. They can get help, medication, medication, but also more so trying to help them cope naturally with meditation, guided imagery, prolonged exposure therapy, which actually gets them to kind of make friends with their symptoms and not see them as something to get them even more scared about, which causes that spiral where they get anxious about being anxious, or depressed about being depressed. And the staff at those types of facilities are really good at, you know, helping patients here and now get back to functioning and to feel less pain and more pleasure in life.
Can you say more about how to make friends with your symptoms? What would that look like for someone struggling with depression or sadness or anger?
All right, I'll give you a great example, and I'm sure you can relate to this from your football days. I used to feel that feeling of anxiety in the pit of my stomach, and I always thought that that meant something bad. And I would actually feel very, very uncomfortable throughout my whole body when I would experience that visceral feeling of anxiety. And when I started doing sports, whenever I would go to compete and I would feel that feeling, I would think that I was going to lose. I thought that I was going to perform badly because I associated the anxiety with a bad thing. But then later on, I had a football coach who one time had a talk to me about this. And, you know, he gave me the talk about, you know, courage is feeling the fear and doing it anyway. It's not the absence of fear. But also, you know, he talked to me and told me that he said, I was always a big kid. And he just said to me, hey, man, you're a big dude. With that feeling, yes, I described that feeling of anxiety to my coach, and my coach said, with that feeling, that's going to make you like the Hulk. It's going to make you so powerful. It's going to give you rocket fuel to run right through those defenders. And it's going to, or in the gym to lift more weights. You don't have to leave the gym in a panic attack. Instead, you could use it. You could kind of sublimate it, turn your scars into stars and use it to help advance your flow. Use it to help push that weight. Use it to help knock people over on the football field, whatever. Use it. It's part of what God gave you, or the universe gave you, to be able to fight when you need to fight and save your life and your loved ones. And that's what it's meant for. But a lot of times people, they want to disavow it. They want to cut it off from themselves. They want to say it doesn't exist, or they want to say, give me a pill to mask it and make it disappear. But instead, we can listen to those symptoms, thereby making friends with them. We can listen to those symptoms, and we can realize that those are our friends, and they're trying to help keep us alive, or win the fight, or win the match, or make people proud of you. Whatever it is that cranks your gears, whatever that makes you want to get up early and stay up late, whatever that is that drives you, if you can use your pain to spur you and be your goad to accomplish great things. And your body is all for it. Your body is listening loud and clear because your body is programmed genetically to get this cocktail, this biomedical cocktail running through your veins and make you sharp, make you stronger, faster, think clearer. That's how you can make friends with it. And soldiers like that kind of language. They like framing it in that way. They really do. They don't want to see it as something like they have some sort of disorder or they have some sort of a handicap of something. They want to be able to see, okay, this is what my body is trying to do for me by giving me these signals, in this case, fear, anxiety. And this is what, you know, this is what it's trying to do for me. It's my ally. And when I feel that feeling, I don't have to run from it. I can embrace it. And that is in part some of the logic behind good therapies for PTSD, such as prolonged exposure, in which instead of getting you know, I remember when I came back from a deployment, it was hard for me because I had PTSD and some agoraphobic traits, and I didn't want to go to the mall. So I just avoided the mall. I was, because I didn't want to feel that feeling of the crowd and danger. I didn't want to feel that feeling. So I avoided malls, but my life was getting smaller and smaller. You know, so, I mean, so what is it? Every time I experience a panic attack or some sort of a problem, I have to just avoid those situations that triggered it? No, that's giving your power away to the triggers. So I just and was thinking that in prolonged exposure therapy, they actually get you to go to the mall. In fact, they assign you to go once a day or whatever you agree to, whatever you can handle that's not too far outside your comfort zone. And so you kind of negotiate that with your therapist in prolonged therapy. And eventually it's like, okay, how many times are you going to the mall now? Well, I only had to go because my kid's birthday was there once a month, you know, last month. You know, maybe I'll go before Christmas because my wife is going to make me. All right, so you're going twice a week. You're going twice in 6 months. So you're averaging about four times a year going to the mall because you feel you have to. All right, so what can we do to step that up a little bit? Do you think you could go every day? Why not? Okay, and getting you to face your fears. Okay, how long can you stay in there for? How long can you tolerate? Well, I can tolerate 4 minutes. Okay, let's go for eight. You know, and then the person is kind of thinking of it as a challenge and a game that they can win. And pretty soon, you're actually moving towards the thing that you fear the most. And after a while, I could walk around the mall and just do laps and laps and laps and not even think about the time because I got used to it. Paradoxically, by moving towards something and giving yourself more of that thing that you fear, you paradoxically can turn that around and feel less arousal and less stress associated with that trigger. So pretty soon the trigger is going off and you don't even hear it anymore. It's lost its power over you because you made it attenuate. You made it kind of peak and then come down by moving towards it instead of what I always intuitively thought was the right answer, which was to run away from it. Avoid it. I mean, after all, if it's making you sick, avoid it. So that's what I was thinking about that.
Is there a practice, a routine, a ritual that you have on a daily basis to keep your or any triggers manageable? Are there things that you do just to keep your mind sharp? You're like, I got to do this on a daily basis. I got to sharpen the blade every day, and here's how I do it.
Oh, definitely. If it wasn't for, I need to sharpen my saw on a daily basis, emotionally, spiritually, psychically. And I have to do it every day. And the very biggest thing that helps me the most is to go for a walk. If I get nervous about something, just like I said, with going to the mall too, I was using my body. And I was walking around and around. So every day I have to do some sort of physical exercise. I love things that are repetitive, like swimming or walking, that are rhythmic. And you can kind of put yourself in a nice trance while you're doing it. So you get the mental effect and the physical effect in one. And I just love doing those. And I can really distract myself with my footsteps into really thinking deeply about something that's bothering me. And those two things are just, you know, putting my feet on the ground and feeling grounded and breathing. We control our breathing, man. We control everything. You know, before a bull charges or an eagle takes flight, they instinctively breathe in cool, rich oxygen. You know, and they exhale the toxic carbon dioxide, you can just let it drift and float away out of their fingertips. And breathing, you control your breathing, you control your state. And so while I'm doing that walking I was describing, I'm really paying attention to my breathing. When I'm swimming or boxing or whatever it is, I'm weightlifting, I'm just really focused on my breathing. So that way, when I'm in kind of a more sterile setting, you know, let's say a business meeting or a tense family meeting or whatever it is you're doing, and I start to feel that autonomic nervous system kick in, and I start to feel my heart beating in my chest, I know that instead of running out of the meeting, and losing out on that opportunity, I know that all I need to do is just kind of close my eyes if I can, if it's appropriate, or even just fixate on a single point across the room. Just focus my eyes on that single point and just take a few deep breaths, as conspicuously or inconspicuously as you want them to be. Just take a few deep breaths and keep looking at the people in the meeting that you're talking to, across the boardroom table, whatever. And you can just take a few cleansing breaths. You can imagine yourself in your happy place, so to speak. I know that sounds a little hokey, but you can imagine your place of perfect peace, love, and harmony, you know, and you can imagine you're breathing in warm rainbows of sunshine and exhaling stress and tension. And I just do that. And it brings back the positive states that I get from athletic activities or working out, walking, whatever. So it's like you can capture it in that moment and then reinvigorate it later.
I mean, that it definitely clocks with what I've learned and what the science supports in terms of keeping your eye contact on something for 90 seconds can kind of help reset your nervous system or help you to zoom out or connect more to your breath. And that whole body scan. And I love how you mentioned earlier about finding something that's rhythmic and repetitive as a way of channeling the energy, whether it's walking or swimming. I know for myself, to hear the gravel under my boots when I'm going for a hike, there's something soothing about that, which is why, you know, I stopped taking my headphones with me, because I need to hear my breathing. And I need to hear the world around me. That's part of the stress release.
Yeah, and you know what's an extra benefit of that too, Leo, you just made me think of, is that when you're focused on something else, you're controlling your focus, when you're controlling your focus, it distracts you from those things that are triggering you. And that can make you even stronger.
Did you say a statue?
No. If you focus on those things, they distract you. They distract you, yes. Like a magician that says, look over here, focus on this. And you're focused. And sometimes it's also clearing your mind of all that chatter that has accumulated in there. And that way of clearing your mind and just focusing on a single point of focus concentration that you were describing, that you're looking at, it just pulls you towards it.
And you have a son. Do you have only one kid? How many kids do you have?
I have two sons.
Okay. And are these some of the things that you taught your children? Because when I think about kids, when they're very young, they typically have a challenging time emotionally regulating. Were these some of the things that you taught them, or did they teach you other ways of how to emotionally regulate?
Yes. I have learned probably just as much from them as they have from me, which, you know, makes me kind of feel odd as the parent sometimes, because I'm always trained to be like, okay, I'm gonna tell you, I will talk, you will listen, and you know, I'm their primary coach, I'm their primary guide, I'm their teacher, I'm their counselor, I'm their best friend, but they've taught me just as much about how to be a great dad as I've taught them.
When your son decided that they wanted to transition from one gender to the next, what were some of the thoughts that went through your mind at the time of learning this, and what were the emotions that you were experiencing?
Oh yeah, that if if emotions were vegetables, I would have been a tossed salad when that reality was presented to me one fateful day. See, my older son was actually born female and was raised under a different name. And always just was my little girl and got used to raising a little girl and all that goes with it. And I just remembered one time around 10 years old, she started to act differently and her behaviors started to change. And she suddenly didn't want to go swimming anymore or do other things that she loved to do because she was really focused on her body, preoccupied with her body image, was starting to have body dysmorphia coinciding with the onset of puberty. And one day, and I've always been very close to her. And then one day, she wanted to kill herself. And that's every father's nightmare, is that, you know, something like this would happen to their child. The worry, the anxiety, the self-blame, how did this happen? And, you know, then we got her involved in counseling, and she started to share with the counselor that she unequivocally felt that she was a male and wanted to change her name and change her identity and how she identifies. And so she began a long process of transition. We my wife and I made her wait as long as we possibly could, and there was a lot of delays, so didn't start to transition until about age 16. So we made him, well, actually 17, and so we made him wait as long as we could. And I always tend to run a little bit on the conservative side, I guess politically. That kind of went along with my military experiences. But having a kid that you love, you know, bring this to you really is earth shattering, not only obviously for them, I'm sure it was a difficult conversation for them to have with their dad, but to have a conversation like that is earth shattering, because it's just, you can't help but go over it in your mind over and over again. Did I do something wrong as a parent? And going through this process and ultimately accepting it and allowing my daughter to go through with it. And now I refer to him by the pronouns he and she, and I mean he and him, and I call him by his new name. And I thought this was going to be a disaster, and it seems to have a very good outcome, because I've never seen my son, this person, happier. And he really fits the identity, and he seems much more congruent and much more harmonious, and his depression is gone. And I know that I researched the heck out of this when I was in the throes of this, and there's a lot of outcomes where it doesn't go good. It doesn't go well. There's a lot of bad outcomes out there, unfortunately, for these people. And, you know, some will say they're indoctrinated, and, you know, this is, you know, trickling down from feminism or all of that political stuff that I don't like to get involved in. But I have to say that although I still lean conservative, you know, I've become a lot more liberal on this particular issue. Maybe because it hit so close to home for me, it woke me up and got me to be sensitized to
and more actually in tune with my child than I ever was before. It got me engaged with him, and we're so much closer now. And I think he feels extra love for and from his dad because he knows how difficult this was for me to support him in this, because it went against everything that I stood for. But it's really sensitized me and caused me to revisit this issue. And now he's 19 and he's happy. He's healthy. He's got friends and relationships he never had before. And he really seems to know who he is. It was really kind of funny when I was trying to teach him how to shave. That was a hallmark moment. But yeah, I love my boys, Leo. I love my boys.
I know it takes like a 2 to 3 year process. How long did the transition take from a physical standpoint?
Let's see. You know what it was a lot like, Leo? It, especially in hindsight, looking back on the last, so it's been 2 years now. It really came on. He started with testosterone. They gave him this gel. And, you know, first he had to go through counseling and other things to make sure that, you know, he was doing his due diligence to make sure this is what he really wanted, or in his case demanded. And after counseling, they then started him on testosterone. And then it was a lot like going through puberty. It was a lot like he was going through puberty, because he just, as a male, but you remember, you know, when we were young and going through puberty, it took a while for us to get a little beard and our voice to change, and the changes happen slowly and gradually in most men. But in this case with my son, it happened slowly and gradually, and now he has a little mustache and his voice has changed. And he just looks different. He walks different. He carries himself different. Totally different.
What's been the? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. No, I was just gonna say that. You know, sometimes I look at him like, "Who are you?" You know, I see this magnificent young man sitting in front of me, so comfortable in his own skin. Whereas before he was so awkward and uncomfortable, and just, you could see him just anguishing over every move he makes. And to see him now, I look at him like, "Who are you, and what have you done with my child?"
What's been the social feedback, you know, neighbors, family, friends, church?
Wow, that's a great question. Very germane. It was funny. We had a couple of friends in the neighborhood that were kind of superficial with us, but they were nonetheless acquaintances. Very friendly, cordial, and kind of reaching out to us sometimes, and we'd reciprocate. And then after this transition happened, a couple of them immediately started avoiding us. You know, I would, I'd like to say that we tried to make it discreet as we could, so as not to attract undue attention. But the changes in my son when he'd be walking around the neighborhood or seeing other kids from school and then them reporting back to their parents, It was quite clear that people knew what was going on, and he stopped getting misgendered at some point also very quickly. And so people just kind of knew, and it was amazing to see the people kind of fall precipitously when the news was officially broke. But that's okay. That's okay. And I had mentioned to you that the coup de grace for me that made me support my son with this was I didn't want him to commit suicide. And that was a big worry on my part, is I asked myself, would I rather have a deceased son because I'm going to be stubborn and go against this, or would I rather have somebody who's, you know, changing their identity in a way that's very hard for me as a Generation Xer. It's very hard for me to contemplate that and accept that. And, you know, so I really had to decide, you know, is safety more important than my opinion of this matter and my desire to do what I think is right for my son? You know, and that's one instance that I definitely have learned a lot from my sons. This is, you know, something I couldn't learn from a book. I had to learn it by, you know, my son telling me. And I was actually kind of proud of him for his courage, because this was very hard. And, you know, he was very courageous. He's going for what he believes in. I don't agree with it, but I love my son more.
You love your son more than your beliefs. It's
yes. Right. Yeah. Yep. Or my opinion on this matter. And I also realize the older I get, you know, cause I'm a little older than you, Leo. I think you're 42, right?
47.
47. Oh, okay. Well, you look 42.
I get that.
Yeah. Life just, you know, teaches me that the wiser I become, the more I know, the less conviction I have to hold on to beliefs that don't serve me anymore. And to also realize that I don't know everything. You know, I think that's real wisdom, is to know that I don't know everything. And so when my son presented me with this, you know, I just was able to look to God, look to the sky and just say, you know, this is beyond my pay grade, sir. And, you know, God, you're going to have to help me with this. You know, because I knew it was bigger than me. And I also know that I'm not an expert. I don't really know, you know, the real meaningful philosophical questions, you know, about making meaning of this matter in a way that's most empowering to everybody involved. It's very complicated and it's beyond me. I can't wrap my brain around it. If I was younger, I probably would have been more rigid and I would have been a little bit more arrogant in my own beliefs. Like, nope, my map is my territory. You know, it's not the territory. It's just we all have our map of the territory, but as we grow older, it's incumbent upon us to always refine it and learn and make new distinctions and grow. And my kids have helped me grow because, you know, I'm much more able to connect with people now that I kind of got over myself in a way. And my sons, this whole thing was the coup de grace that pushed me over the edge and made me really, you know, realize and really get it, that I don't know everything and that I can learn from every single situation I immerse myself in.
Well, the fact that you're using words like coup de grace lets me know you're definitely Air Force. That I don't know a lot of Marines that know the word coup de grace, or you used malaise earlier. Darren, yep. This is awesome, and I feel like I could talk to you for hours. We're going to have you back on because there's so much more I want to peel back. But penultimate.
Oh, wow, I'd love to.
Yeah, penultimate question. I always imagine there's one person listening in who may be on the precipice of wanting to end their life. Before you kill yourself, what would you say to them, Darren?
Oh, absolutely. Love that question. I would tell them this. I would tell them that there is always hope and you ain't out of this yet. And you got to get back in the saddle and you got to don't give up. Don't quit on yourself. Don't quit on the world. There are people that love you and need you, and people give a darn. I know you don't think that they do, but there are people that really care about you very deeply. And, you know, if I was their friend, loved one, or just happened to, you know, come across a bridge that they were standing on and was trying to talk them down from the bridge, I would just tell them, I give a shit. I care. I care. And I'm here. And I won't leave you. You know, and I would stay with them. You know, and then once we got them down from the bridge, then I'd talk to them a little bit more directly and just say, look, you know, let's get you help. You know, let's go somewhere. Let's get you safe. And I'd take them to a safe place. I'd make sure I got them there, even if I had to call 911. But I wouldn't leave them and I wouldn't minimize it. You know, I remember reading a study. Perhaps you read this when you were getting your master's psychology. I had read an amazing study. I don't remember off the top of my head what it was, but it was about these people that jumped off a bridge and they hit the water, and some of them lived. You know, maybe 20% of them lived. And I don't remember what bridge this was. It might have been San Francisco, but it was a long way down to the water. And some of them lived, and they interviewed these people when they came to and came out of their comas or whatever they were in. And they interviewed them. And the counselors invariably asked the patients, what was the first thing you thought of when you let go of the railing and you were falling? And the people invariably said, oh shit, I don't want to die, you know, as they're on their way down. And some of them lived. And they later on tracked these people and followed up with them. And when the people were doing better in their lives and things were going well for them, they asked them, you know, thinking back to your experience, what did you need to have happen for you not to go to that bridge that day? And a lot of them then admitted that they had been going to that bridge again and again and again, rehearsing, kind of getting up, working up the nerve. So there was, even in the most decisive people that were willing to carry out this mistake, they you know, these people had conviction, but every single one of them had ambivalence. And it was usually after they let go of the railing that they realized, I don't want to die. And they feel like it was a blessing when they wound up living. They couldn't believe it. Their whole life flashed before their eyes. And they're like, what am I doing? I don't want to die. I want to live. I want to make something of myself. This is a temporary solution to it. This is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And my problem seems so small in perspective compared to dying. And it was like, you know, they survived suicide and it was very freeing for them. And they'll tell the interviewer something like this. They'll say, I just wish that somebody had stopped and talked to me and told me they gave a shit about me, whether I lived or died. Someone to show that they give a darn, that they care, that they stop. If that would have happened, I wouldn't have jumped off the bridge that fateful day. And I'll never forget that story.
I appreciate you sharing that story because, you know, at the end of every episode, we always emphasize how important it is to reach out and call someone. I had someone send me an email saying how they on the precipice of wanting to end their life, but they listened to the episode. And I was like, you know, I appreciate everyone who listens to the episode, but know that this is only part of it. You know, if you're not reaching out and talking to someone, you're not going to complete the cycle of the healing, and it's going to be hard for you to move forward. Last question here, Darren. What are you looking forward to in the next 24 hours?
Oh, boy. Well, a good night's sleep tonight. I love to sleep. Usually, you know, curling up with a good book. And of course, talking to my wife before bed. And kissing my younger son on the head and tucking him to bed. Those are my favorite things.
What book are you reading right now?
Oh, I'm actually reading a book that's called, what is it called? I actually started it on the cruise, and then I put it down for a couple of weeks when I got back from the cruise, and I just started reading it again. And it's a really good book. It's The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls.
Ah, The Glass Castle, yes.
The Glass Castle. It's just about this really dysfunctional family that, you know, raises this little girl. And it's really a tale of resilience for this little girl and how she was able to, you know, overcome so much that, you know, the bad card she was dealt as a little girl.
Darren,
it's a great book.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. We'll have you back on. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Remember, this podcast is not a substitute for calling the 988 or any of the other 800 numbers. You can chat, talk, text. You can go to thrivewithleo.com for one-on-one coaching with yours truly. Let's get to tomorrow together. Thank you so much, Darren.
All right. Thanks for having me.